Hello.
Hello.
Oh, you're trying to wait me out this time.
Yes. Well, I was waiting out call recorder, but, you know, this is how these
Is your
things
call
go.
recording?
It is. Does it sound like it's on the right microphone?
Yes, it does.
Ah, man.
Do I sound like I'm awake or I'm asleep this time? Because, boy, I was mostly dead in that Spider-Verse episode, wasn't I?
No. You were pulling through like a champ. Yeah. Although I don't know, I wouldn't fault you for being sleepy because you just finished watching John Carter.
It's been a very long day. Well, yeah. John Carter didn't really put me to sleep or anything because it was so boring. I was distracted by other things occurring around me and my telephone and such.
Mm. Yeah. What would you do if you had watched this in a movie theater and it would have been rude to turn on your phone?
I probably would have taken a nap because, you know, it's cold in there. They got the big comfy chairs. Probably wouldn't have walked out because I don't think I've ever walked out of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me neither. Well, did I? I don't know. I don't remember ever doing that, but I wouldn't, like, wager money. But there's certainly movies that I've turned off when I'm watching them at home. That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Not anything we've done for this podcast, though.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Of course not.
No. Well, except, I guess, that one time I didn't finish Fast Time at Ridgemont High because I just didn't care and we were running out of time. So I just kind of skipped through it.
Wait, what? We didn't do Fast Times on this.
Didn't we? What am
I talking
thinking
about? Dazed and Confused?
Yes, that's the one.
Oh, it's so offensive.
Sorry. Same thing. High school movie.
Not only is it offensive that you didn't finish the movie because it's great, but you confused it with Fast Times, which is fine, but it's not Dazed and Confused.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind when I don't watch that one either.
I don't think I've even seen all of Fast Times.
Mm.
You got your Spicoli, and then you got Beverly Hills Cop sidekick there, and he's got like a mall food court outfit on.
Yeah.
That's Phoebe Cates. And that song from the Cars.
Maybe we should just talk about other movies that we can't remember things about rather than this movie that we just watched.
Yeah. I can't remember a ton about this movie either. Mm. But as I was sort of watching it out of the corner of my eye while scrolling through my phone, I realized that John Carter is... stay with me here. It is a $263 million Shrek on Mars.
Oh. No.
I mean, a more complicated version, but you got your princess.
Mm-hmm.
You got your rescuing the princess from marrying the evil bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
You got the breaking into the wedding right at the last moment to save him. And you got your hijinks with the tribes and then the people who help. There's, I mean, it's not really a donkey, but you get that weird sort of like, Hamburglar looking
yeah, they're like
dog thing,
gecko dog.
Well, not Hamburglar. Who's the guy whose head was a hamburger?
Mayor McCheese.
Mayor McCheese. There you go.
Yes, if Mayor McCheese was a lizard dog, I would say there are parts of this that kind of remind me of Avatar uncharitably, which of course then means Ferngully, and then of course you got some Indiana Jones wannabe stuff and a dash of Spaceballs at the end when it comes to that wedding is how I feel about that. I don't care who gets married, but somebody's getting married.
It's astounding how many times they repeat themselves when there's so much dialogue in this movie that it could so easily have been cut down. Like, there's so much talking.
Yeah, and
for no reason.
Well, it's not for no reason, because otherwise you would not have the information imparted to you in any other way, because you're not seeing some of the events that they're describing. But
I mean, but they're all just staring at each other and slowly walking towards each other from across the little set and pleading their case, and mm-hmm. then resisting the case, and then pleading the case a different way, and then somebody comes in to distract them so they couldn't finish their conversation, so they have the conversation again in a different place. It's all just, it's the same. And then you got mm-hmm. Mark Strong in there. I got to tell you, I legitimately blacked out when Mark Strong was taking John Carter to wherever he was taking him.
On the elevator ride? The slowest elevator ride ever?
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
Yeah.
Where he was, like, giving him the lowdown on everything. I don't know what happened there. Like, I lost like 6 minutes of my life, and then I woke up and he was still standing there like on like some sort of balcony talking. I was like, what in God's name just happened?
What he was doing, well, let's not skip to the end of the movie, but that's bad for different reasons. But there's so much of this, to your point, that is repetitive, where it feels almost like somebody wrote it into the script so that information would get across, and then put it in all the other scenes just in case that scene got cut, and then they just left it in.
Well, you got this dialogue, you got a fair amount of flashbacks, you actually have some of the information coming across just from like character traits, so it's in there, not it's in there like multiple times in multiple ways.
Yeah. Speaking of flashbacks, this whole movie itself is sort of a flashback. And within that flashback, you have flashbacks. And I don't have any affection for the wife flashback storyline thing.
They burned his house down. And, he shouts at the inner cutting with the burying the family and the fight scene.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost comical.
Yes, because it was absurd and not connected. Although it's supposed to be like what motivates him, that he must protect his Mars, not quite wife, but lady friend.
his girl pal he's been arguing with the entire time, and then forcibly kissed one time.
Yes. Just great.
So that means they're in love.
Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest flaw for me is that this is a movie named John Carter. It is about John Carter, and so many scenes have John Carter doing and saying things that they probably should have bothered to make John Carter interesting at some point in the development process, and they probably should have cast someone who had charisma instead of someone who's completely boring.
Yeah, I feel like they had hoped he was going to develop into the character over the course of shooting the movie, and then by the time they got to the second and third movies, he'd really be Sam Worthington ending it up or something, and then he would be big franchise boy. But Taylor Kitsch, you know, he broke on the scene and then was immediately cast backwards, saying nope.
Yeah.
Let's not do that at all.
No, I mean, I don't usually, on this podcast, I don't usually fault actors a lot of times because they're usually given like bad direction or poor material to work off of. But even when he had like very basic things to do, it just didn't happen. You know, he threw himself 100%, literally threw himself into all the physical stunt work that was required. And I'm sure that maintaining that like 8-pack or whatever for the entire filming of this production was not an easy feat either. But
like Gyllenhaal did that for Prince of Persia, and look where that got him.
Yeah, and it's just, I don't know. You can't make this movie about this guy that is boring. It.
I mean, he
kills
squints.
It.
He talks a little bit in a Batman voice sometimes. He's got hair that dangles in front of his face.
Ugh.
He likes to grab a lot of people by the arm and then like lean in and say things
through gritted teeth.
He's got no depth. I mean, he's got a dead lady and daughter, and he's looking for gold in them thar hills.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds his gold, but it's also happens to be in a cave where he coincidentally runs into a spaceman at the same time in a robe who freaks out and tries to shoot him, and then he shoots him first, and then he accidentally touches his medallion and he goes to Mars.
Now, Dan, you're missing the really important part, which is that this movie starts with a red Disney logo.
yeah, because Mars.
Super saturated red, which has no connection to anything you see on Mars through the movie.
Yeah, Mars is not red in this movie.
No, because it's not
yellow.
It's not red, but it just looks like, you know, Utah.
I was waiting for him to stand up at one point and go, "Mars, the red planet," and then turn around and go, Wait.
Yeah, no, but the they start with that ridiculous logo thing, and then they have the long ago whatever with Willem Dafoe narrating as this omniscient narrator telling you that there used to be water on Mars and it was great and stuff, and then it all went to crap, and there's only these two warring cities left, and you have...
Right, because the city was moving and it was eating the planet or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It was the Peter Jackson movie where the planets are cars.
Yeah, the cities are cars. Not the planets.
That's what I meant.
That's going to be the sequel to that because it was so successful.
the planet is being eaten by cities that are cars.
Mm-hmm. And which,
John Carter, which is here in his car,
which is itself, I feel like, inspired by, was it Final Fantasy VIII or whatever? They had cities that went to battle with each other. It's all stupid. But you know, other than that Final Fantasy VIII connection and the weirdness of the cities battling, you basically just have these two whatever cities, and you got your good city, which has a monarchy, and then you have your bad city, which also has a different monarchy. But
you got your red city and your blue city,
mm-hmm.
and your one city and your two city, and one city all has stars on their bellies, and the other city doesn't have stars on their bellies,
and they have
and jealous.
Hey, reference acknowledged. I was gonna let it just go.
I was like, how long did I have to go?
Yeah.
And then somebody comes to town with a machine, and that machine is John Carter, and he's like, you know what? I'll give you stars on your bellies over here, but I'm not for hire. I'm a rogue, and I put stars on the bellies of whomever I please.
Dan, are you okay?
It's very hot in here.
Oh man. Yeah, it's 81 degrees in here. But
And then Willem Dafoe is all like, who speaks for the trees? Because they died, because the water's gone.
Dan, I'm cutting you off.
All right, go ahead.
The stuff has been deep soused. Get it? Like deep sixed?
It took me a second, but I got it.
Okay. Yes. It's off the menu. But the part of this is that there's an airship battle, and then it's silly and bad looking, and then Mark Strong and two other people levitate down from the sky with a terrible lens flare and like some weird like undulating cloud whatever thing, and then they walk over to our bad guy of this movie. I believe his name is Dominic West, the actor, who I don't recall seeing in anything else, but maybe he has done stuff.
He was in 300.
Oh,
he was the bad guy. It was Rapey McSenator.
Mm. Well,
he's in other stuff too. He's a British fella.
Yeah, just sort of. Yes, maybe.
Tomb Raider, The Punisher. What did I just see him in recently? He's okay.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I'm glad you like him. But he gets this.
He's in that movie I worked on. He's in Pride. Anyway,
he gets a. This energy weapon thing, which kind of looks like one of those sculptural toys that you see in a museum store.
Yeah, it's like a 3D printed. It's like when they the new modern like 3D printed casts, mm-hmm. But it's blue.
Yeah, and so he gets that, and then he tries to use it immediately on the people who gave it to him, and then he gets his butt knocked back, and then he still gets it because he's been selected by the goddess. And this just lets you know this is gonna be bad, because. Now he's going to do this thing. And then we go to London, where Burroughs is arriving, and we don't care about him. And we're like, why is London so weird? And they're just, you know, have American lawyer guy in the estate of other American guy who was the uncle of Edgar Rice Burroughs, who's there, and he gets to read the will.
You got your Mars cold open, and then you got your B level characters London cold open, and then you got the narrator kind of guy cold open, and then John Carter's there, and he's like, he's Taylor Kitsch with a funny hat and a trench coat, and he's like, Western Union, send my message to this guy or whatever.
Yeah, and by this point, we've changed radically in scene and setting and characters, and we still don't know what the heck is going on, because...
And it's hard to express how quickly they make you not care about literally anyone in the movie, because you're like, all right, cool, Mars people and aliens and stuff, whatever. And then like, yeah, it's old-timey London, and, you know, these people aren't John Carter. Stuff's happening here. Probably germane to the plot. I don't care. And then John Carter's there, and you're like, about time. And he's like, send a message for me. Come quick. And then he walks away, and you're like, what? And then there's a kid on a train, and you're like, probably the kid who was getting the thing, because he's got the letter in his pocket. And then the butler's on the train platform going like, come quick or whatever. And you're like, what? He was John Carter. He was here for 5 minutes. Where did he go? And then I don't care anymore.
Well, he also goes to pick up stuff from the general store and gets into a fist fight.
That's a time jump, isn't it? Because like he's all like clean, handsome John Carter sending a telegram, and then cut to he's like in the Wild West, Arizona, all dirty, like, give me some beans, pointing a gun at some guy.
Yeah. And we just really have no idea what's going on. And he beats up these guys. Still don't care about him.
Because he wants his beans.
Yeah. And his line delivery of beans. The first item is beans. Is extremely distracting and weird and not fun. I don't really understand the direction he was given or what he thought
somebody,
he was accomplishing.
Somebody was watching a Harrison Ford movie when they wrote that line, and they're like, yes,
well,
he can do this.
This is part of Andrew Stanton's pitch to Disney about making this movie, apparently, was that it's like Indiana Jones, but on Mars. So I feel like...
Except without the charismatic character.
Yes. I feel like Andrew Stanton's instructions to Taylor Kitsch were, just be Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones and just be in the movie. And then you can do that, right? And then Taylor says, yes, I can. And then everyone believed him.
I can do that.
And then he's in it. And just as wooden as the set. And so he doesn't...
As wooden as the set? Is that what you just said?
Yes. And then there's the guys who come in who work for the army. And they're like, you're so-and-so, you're coming with us. And
I suggest you come peacefully. Which is how you know they're old-timey, because they talk like that.
Yeah. And also, I have to point out that they try to do some comedy editing. Where it's like, I'm not going to do this, and then cut to...
Oh, you talk about the scene where he's getting interviewed by Bryan Cranston, and he keeps jumping out the windows?
Yeah, which is immediately what happens after this. And and you're just like, Bryan Cranston, why are you in here? Like, there's no real reason for him to be there, because I'm just thinking to myself, we're eventually going to go to Mars. Is Bryan Cranston going to Mars, or is Bryan Cranston just in a weird cameo? And the answer is Bryan Cranston is just in a weird cameo, because... they immediately go to try to broker peace with, I believe it was the Apache tribe?
Oh, my God.
There?
Like, he's running away, and then, like, they do that scene that they do in every movie that's in the West, where, like, they all suddenly stop, and the camera tilts up, and, like, there's a bunch of Native Americans on the ridge, and, oh, God, there's a standoff. And he starts to talk to them, and Bryan Cranston is all like, what are they saying? And the nervous guy shoots one of them, and it's like, okay, great. Now we're all in a battle here, and Taylor Kitsch rides away, and then Bryan Cranston gets shot. And even though Taylor Kitsch is a rebel, and he has no alliances to anybody, he decides to go back and save Bryan Cranston, and picks him up and puts him on the back of his horse and rides away real fast, because, you know, he doesn't take orders from anybody, but he's got a righteous heart or whatever. Mm. So he's riding away with Bryan Cranston, and then he like sets the horse loose and tries to run up a hill real fast, hoping that they'll follow the horse tracks. But, that's stupid, because they just like look, and he's like over there to the right, like 20 yards. And they're like, hey, he's over here by this little cave. And then Taylor Kitsch looks up and he mutters spider, 'cause he's been looking for a cave with a spider. And for no reason other than he heard that there's a cave with a spider logo that has gold in it or something. Mm. They got the high ground. They're at the mouth of the cave, you know, trying to fight off the Native Americans. And then, he's enamored by the spider cave. And then, a bald, robed, Mars alien guy pops out of nowhere and goes, oh crap. And then, they try to shoot each other, and, he gets his gun out faster, because he's the fastest gun in the Western spider cave.
And so he mortally wounds the guy who is one of the guys that we had seen in the opening to this movie.
Yeah, who like tries to quickly beam himself back to Mars as he's dying.
He has a special amulet with a
A special amulet to beam himself back to Mars. He doesn't do it quick enough because John Carter grabs his amulet and he's like, "What are you saying?" And then he repeats the word, and then suddenly he goes to Mars instead, which is an uh-oh.
Yeah, Barsoom. Barstool.
I know Barstool. I sit there all the time and drink because I'm a drunk and I search for gold in mountains and stuff.
Well, I thought you were going to go with Barstow.
Oh, God. Why would you go to Barstow?
Well, it's got an in and out, so you can stop there on your way to Vegas. Yeah. But
That's the reason to go.
And then leave somewhere as fast as possible. But he lands on Mars in a field, and we're supposed to know that it's not quite where he was because there's just sort of a mossy green texture to some of the plants and a filter. And it's not that alien-ish right now, except
no,
that...
It would have been too much of a giveaway if it was... red, so it's just, you know, it's just desert, it's just yellow.
Well, Mars isn't really red.
Well, it's the red planet.
I know, but, like, if you were on Mars, like, if you look at any of the modern photography that's been conducted by
any
of the rovers...
those photos could be doctored.
Yes, from the fake Mars rover landings, but...
By the atmosphere. The atmosphere is doctoring the photos. Yeah. Like, they haven't quite figured out how to, you know, adjust the white balance.
Yeah, but, I mean, it is also weird that they go through some trouble for like the gravity thing, and they're like, look, he's so strong because of gravity, and it's like, yeah, but there's no air, like, are we being like real scientists about this one?
They even point out in the beginning of the movie that there's no air.
Yeah, it doesn't, I don't understand.
It's not because of the gravity, it's because of the density of his bones, remember?
Oh yeah, I forgot.
Which has what to do with anything?
That was just the princess's guess. It's not like she like did an autopsy or anything. She just looked at him and she's like, "You've got strong bones." And it's like, that's not how that works.
She's a very sciencey princess though, because she's inventing the blue ray gun that the aliens want to get rid of. So that I don't know why they didn't choose to ally with the people who already kind of had the blue ray gun powers. Maybe just because they were the good people and they wanted the bad guys. Well, it's never clear why they choose which side.
Don't want them to destroy them because they're bad, Dan. It's very simple.
So you're saying they sabotaged the blue ray gun because the blue ray gun could kill the robe aliens?
Well, no, the robe aliens sabotage because they're in disguise, remember? So the robe alien...
Why did they sabotage her blue ray gun?
They sabotaged her blue ray gun because she was close to discovering the ninth ray, and then they could use the ninth ray to do good stuff. And what we don't find out until the very end of this movie, in the horrible, horrible Mark Strong monologuing thing that goes on forever, is...
Oh, I missed this then, probably.
Yeah, is that I forget how he phrases it, but they feed off of the energy of dying planets, and they go to them. So
he's like a roving city car in that he's eating the planet for energy.
Yeah, but like more of like a wireless charger, I guess, because it's not like they're like consuming anything. But
you don't know, maybe he could go home and eat some dirt.
That's what they do off screen. But they want to prevent her from doing this. Now, what doesn't make any sense is something that he's asked about directly later on by Taylor Kitsch's John Carter, where he's just like, you know, why didn't you just like kill her and like get it over with? And he's like, oh, it's so complicated, you know, we can't do that, we need to disprove her, and you know, this way the war will go, blah, blah. It's just like, that doesn't like really make any sense. You're just like,
yeah, they can't intervene directly,
excuse.
They can only benefit from the tertiary effects. They're like a Wikipedia article about yourself. Like, you can't edit it yourself. You have to be like a tertiary source before it's legit.
Oh, it's incredibly frustrating.
So they set up Dominic West with a blue ray gun, and he can alter the Wikipedia story for the other people, and then somebody can report on that, and then they can eat that for power.
Yes. And that is theoretically the reason why they do this convoluted plan of sabotaging her little science experiment that she's showing her dad. And then her dad's like, well, I was going to go with your plan, but guess I'm just going to have to marry you off now.
Yeah, they blew up one of our ships, and they're like really serious and stuff. But he said he would stop killing everyone if I let him marry my daughter. So, you know, that's just what we're going to do. Tale as old as time.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Song as old as rhyme.
It's the Iliad or whatever. Mm-hmm. You gotta go marry to help save everybody else. You know, how many daughters would you sacrifice to save your city, planet, whatever?
But I cannot stress this enough. This is not told in a compelling way where we see any reason why this is his last resort, his last option, or why he would even believe that conducting this marriage would do anything beneficial at all, and not just further harm and humiliate and destroy things, because there's no like guarantee that he marries the daughter and then doesn't attack them. But
he walks very fast, so you believe that he is very serious about his plan.
No, this guy's a dum-dum. And aside from the reason of, like, you shouldn't give away your daughter, like, in marriage to resolve diplomatic things, because she's a, you know, human, well, not a human, she's a person with theoretically with agency and stuff, but...
You know, they're very technologically advanced. They got they got feathery bird ships that fly around on air or whatever.
Solar.
Solar yeah. Powered bird feather wing planes. But politically and culturally, they're still very cavemanish in terms of trading people for whatever.
Yeah.
And you see that with the Tharks. I don't know, like stealing or kidnapping. Hatching eggs and then shooting the ones that they don't want, which seems unnecessary.
Mm.
And then you know, the whole you're not supposed to keep your kids thing, where he's got, you know, Willem Dafoe's got a secret daughter that he kept alive or whatever. It doesn't matter. I don't know if I cared, if I would have been able to sort out what they were trying to explain, but I didn't care, so I didn't.
Okay, well, the Horde doesn't have any familial attachments.
So it's like a big open marriage there.
Yeah, but they do have someone in charge of taking care of one of the hatchlings, and so they all get paired off like that. And that's why all the female Tharks beat each other up to try and get hatchlings so that they can take care of them. I don't know the real benefit of having the hatchling. I don't know if that means like you get more resources or something in your household, or when you retire, the hatchling is obligated to take care of you or something. They don't really make it clear why anybody would want any of these screaming little babies, but
no, it's just like Sparta. Like, you know, battle is built into their culture, and everything you do, you fight to get like the best one. Like, you know, mm-hmm. if you want the best hatchling, you're gonna have to fight for it.
Yeah.
So, and if it's the last one, you gotta fight for that too.
So they do this thing, and that's why it comes as a shock later to Thomas Hayden Church, who's here.
But it took me 3/4 of the movie to realize that was him.
Yeah, at first I thought it was Clancy Brown, and then I looked at the Wikipedia, because he's doing like a funny voice too. It's not just his normal speaking voice.
Clancy Brown would have worked.
Yeah. But they have this complicated introduction with the Tharks, where he's bouncing around all over the place, and the boss Thark, whatever his name is, he's played by Willem Dafoe, and he tries to negotiate for Taylor to calm down, and Taylor doesn't and goes for the weapon, and then he gets injured, and then they drag him back and he's captured now. But he's not going to be killed because Willem Dafoe is really impressed by the jumping and seems to want to keep him so that he will jump on command in the future. And there's a language barrier because they're speaking whatever, and he's speaking English. But once they get back and there's the fighting, and then there's the disgraced character played by Samantha Morton, who was the precog in Minority Report, Once she gets John Carter and takes John Carter with the other hatchlings to be washed and blue talcum powdered, then she gives him the, what is it? The water of Mars or whatever. Like
it's got some sort of very serious spiritual fancy name, which has nothing to do with anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's something about like, oh, the spirit of Mars or whatever.
Yeah.
And the voice of Mars is in the water or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he can hear, he can understand people.
Yeah. He basically like hallucinates a little. And then he can understand, what they're all saying.
It's just a big old glass of Duolingo. So now suddenly he understands everything.
And, this is where we meet the guard dog sort of, character. And that is the lizard gecko dog thing, which at first seems very concerned with what Taylor's up to trying to escape. And then it is revealed that it can run super fast and chase Taylor all over the place. And Taylor eventually gets to the place where they're all the other Tharks are having a hootenanny. And he's up on the roof and the dog thing disrupts the party. And then they start hurting the dog for disrupting the party. And then Taylor's like, no, don't do that. And then jumps down.
Again, he's rebel with a heart of gold.
Ugh. Man, he would have saved us a lot of trouble if he just sold his heart at the beginning of this movie. But he...
For some beans and gold.
I wouldn't put it past him. So anyway, he causes some conflict. And then Willem Dafoe's like, hey, this is a mess. And you caused a problem for all of us. So I'm going to have to punish everybody now. And I really wish you wouldn't have done that. Because we got to punish, you know, this other character. Sola.
We got rules around here. You break stuff, you get out of line, we gotta brand you and whip you and stuff.
Yeah, and so Sola gets branded, and there's a little speech about how you know you've taken your punishment, but there's no more room for other marks, so you can't mess up again. Which leads me to believe, like, what could she have possibly done? Like, nobody really seems to be punished in this village as much as she is, and by all accounts she doesn't seem like a terrible person. She just doesn't seem to like stand up for herself, I suppose. So maybe everybody just like takes advantage of that and blames stuff on her, but it's not revealed exactly why. But there's a disruption before John Carter is dealt with because there's an airship battle that's going on. And it's revealed that it's Dominic West and the other ships and the princess is there. It's just a disaster. The robe guy is there, but he's in disguise. So nobody can see him until the camera pans across and then we can see him. The rogue guy is, you know, Mark Strong is whispering like, oh, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that, we need to do this, no killing that person. And it's just like, why does any of this
just
matter?
All I gotta do is just disable their ship or whatever, because we need to keep the princess alive so you can marry her, and then we can unite the two cities, and then you can take over. And then presumably they can eat the planet because they have control over him because he's got the 3D printed thing that they gave him.
It's really contrived. It just goes to further underline that Mark Strong, and the Therns don't really have a plan. It just sort of constantly evolves as it goes along, but it's supposed to be kind of like a plan. They seem very certain about lots of stuff, but it just doesn't make any sense. And they have this battle occur, and John Carter can see the battle happening, and then he sees that the princess is like dangling off, and so he jumps to go rescue her. And in doing so, he starts fighting all the bad guys on the ship, but you know, he doesn't really know the political situation with all this, except for what Willem Dafoe had said on the ground.
And for somebody who has a history in the Civil War or whatever, and who has no allegiances and wants out and doesn't want to be associated with being a cavalryman or whatever for the Union.
Yeah, he made such a big deal at the beginning of this movie.
Yeah, and then for no reason whatsoever, he inserts himself pretty quickly into other people's issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because he thinks he knows best, which is basically just everybody stop fighting, especially don't shoot at the girl, or I'll beat you up.
Yeah, and so they crash the thing into the thing and shoot the stuff, and then they get out of there by jumping out, and things crash and whatever, and all the Tharks are like, oh wow, this is crazy. I knew you were great, so I'm gonna promote you now or whatever. You're going to be my right hand because you rebelled and did this thing you shouldn't have done. I don't know. It Willem Dafoe's logic and any of these decisions he makes as a leader don't really make any sort of consistent sense. Not that Thomas Hayden Church is great or anything, but he does have his character kind of has a point when he objects to Willem Dafoe's leadership. Then decide that the princess will be stuck with Taylor as like the like, I don't know, what was the word they used to describe it, just like they're like paired off, like but like in a
they're both humanoid things. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, they're very sort of just a warlike culture, so it's like, yeah, you know, we're just going to kidnap her too, and then you can hang out with her because whatever. But then there was also part of the deal where they're like, we, you know, the Tharks are like, we have no stake in this battle, so like, let him have her back. Like, who cares? And then he's like, no, we need to protect her. And he's like, fine, if you want us to protect her, then you got to be our dude with a name who's part of our crew thing. And he's like, fine, you can call me the weird name, and I'll do that. Just, I'll continue to be part of your crew and fight for you as long as you save this girl that I met 4 seconds ago and know nothing about.
It's really contrived. But then they make the mistake of going to the temple, which they shouldn't enter. And they do that because of the amulet thing, and he wants to explain all this stuff, and there's all this stuff about the River Iss, and they have this whole thing about how the goddess, you know, the Therns were messengers for the goddess, and that the planet used to be great, but now it's crap. And back when it was great, the Therns walked among everybody, but now they're just like a legend. There's an objection to all of this going on. And then at the very end of the scene, they're caught by the other lady who doesn't like Sola. And they have a thing where they're dragged back to the camp, and they're in trouble because they defiled the temple by entering because they're not Tharks. And then they
forbidden, as they say.
Yeah. And so they must be like punished now, and people are going to be hurt and die and whatever. And this is where Willem Dafoe drags everybody into a tent. And so he makes a big deal about how he's going to deal with this. And then once they're inside the tent, he's like, new plan. You guys are going to get out of here, and you're going to take Sola with you, and she can't die and stuff. And then Taylor Kitsch is like, I figured it out. She's your daughter. And then he like freaks out more, and he's like, yes, well, totally. And we weren't supposed. And then there's this long monologue about how we weren't supposed to have, you know, a daughter that we take care of, but my, you know, mate had the egg in the apartment or whatever, their condo, I don't know, wherever they live. And they watched the egg there, and it hatched, and then so they raised it, and so there's a biological connection. It's not just the Horde.
This is all definitely very important context that we needed to know because it will come into play later, which, no, it does not, because we don't care.
It vaguely comes into play, but it also could not have been in the movie and would have not made that much of a difference, but because their familial connection winds up being the reason why Sola does certain things, and also why Willem Dafoe does certain things for Sola, etc. But
she doesn't even really know the whole connection thing. John Carter's like, do it for your dad. She's like, what? Why would you say that? And he's like, he's your dad. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay. I will defend my dad. And he's like, you don't, whatever.
It's pretty dreadful. But they escape, and they've got three thingies they can ride on, and then there's their lizard dog that's following them. And then Sola figures out that they're going towards Helium and they're not going to Iss. And so Taylor says to her, okay, follow my lead. And then he just moseys up 5 feet over to where the princess lady is, and then says, you're taking us to Helium. You're not taking us to Iss. And it's like, what was the secrecy planning there? Like, what was the importance of having these separate conversations? Sola could have just said it, and we could have saved ourselves like a minute of this movie. But they trade barbs back and forth about how it'll be best for everybody if we go to Helium, because then we could do the thing. And then John Carter's like, you're lying, and I'm going to like make you walk now. And so he...
How many times does he go from like, I'm defending you, but I don't trust you, but... We should stick together, but I work alone. It's just like, can you pick a side and shut up at the same time?
I mean, you don't really root for him in this context because he's very manipulative. It's like, if she wants to go to Helium, then just let her go. Like, I don't know why she needed to be punished by dropping her in the desert, and then she agrees that she'll guide them to Iss.
I mean, she wanted them all to go and be like, you know, the heroes that ride in and say, like, I'm going to help defend Helium or whatever. Yeah. But at this point is when she reveals, like, right, isn't this where she goes, like, I can't marry that dude? And they're like, yeah. What are you talking about? Like, my dad wants to sell me for peace or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're all just kind of like... Well, that's terrible.
Yeah, just like Spaceballs. They go to Iss now, and they're down supplies and a pack animal, but whatever. It's all part of John Carter's clever plan.
I'm going to get her to ride right behind me on my animal by pushing her off of hers. It's like playground tactics about how you tell somebody you like them.
Yeah, and then I'll make my animal carry twice the burden in the desert for no reason. Anyway, so they get to, not that that comes into play at any point, because they get to the river in like 2 seconds, and then they, it's so strange how they have these moments where they're trekking for forever, but then sometimes they just cut and they're at the place.
And then they're on the boat for a really long time with like lots of dissolves and cuts. And then when they have to get back to the shore, it's just like, we're back.
Yes.
And of course, like when they're leaving, they're like, stay here, dog monster. You can't come with us on this tiny little raft. And it's like, oh, sad dog monster. And then like 5 minutes later, they're like, they're back. And it's like, ah, yes, dog monster. Hello. Long time no see.
Yeah. So they go on the river thing, and they see other pilgrims, and for some reason people make a deal about what was it that Sola said, like the pilgrims, you know, go here but they don't come back or whatever. I don't know.
It's like one of their random dead holy places.
None of this stuff comes into play. So they get to the place, which, you know, after all of the talk, would have figured there'd be more to it other than you're here. And then you jump up to the top and the amulet opens a secret door. It seemed like none of those things were really connected in a way that made any sense. But sure enough, the thing opens up, and then they don't say a word to Sola or anything. He just leaves her there and she just waits for them. And so they go inside and they go down this hallway that's extending, and it's the same blue stuff as the 3D printed thing.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, this isn't natural, this is a machine. And it's like, who cares?
Well, she cares, because she's like, it's like the thing that I was inventing. And so they get to the end of this hallway, which is a room of some description, and they are greeted with the spider design, which then shifts around, and it's the planets, and John Carter's like, oh, wow, and she's like, ninth ray, and they're like, the planets, and then they start naming them, and he's like, that one's Mercury, and then that one's Venus, that one's Earth, and she's like, oh, that's Jarsoom, and he's like, Earth.
No, it's Earth. It's like, guys, there's a language barrier. Yeah. There's multiple words for the same thing. Figure it out.
Which apparently the voice of Mars does not help them resolve. But they have that exchange over that, and there's some text that comes up, like an infographic about some information on the line, and then she does one of those classic acting beats of, I can read and understand this, and I'm shocked, but I'm going to say that I can't.
I need more information. I need my books, my sacred texts.
Yeah, and so then she gets grabbed by the arms again, as you do, and he shakes her and says, "You just want to go back to Helium.
Stop lying to me. Where is the trigger?"
Yeah, and then they go outside.
No, they go outside because there's a shot fired that they hear.
Right, right. There's what's her name in the boat? Shoots up in the air, and they run back out. She's like, "Look!" And then there's all the they're like tharks, but they went through like the ooze or something. Mm. So they're all like gnarly with like spikes coming out of their back and like extra like angry.
Yeah, she says wild horde. They're being manipulated by Mark Strong, who tells, I guess, their leader, like, you know, kill the Thark, capture the princess, and see what the other guy can do. And which is weird, because again, it's like, this doesn't really seem like a plan, and you're all sort of all powerful-ish, kind of. And able to be anywhere on this planet and do lots of things, and yet you're just like, oh, I'm going to set up this really complicated plan of capturing this person. But they cut back to them being at the shore and getting on their animals nearly as the Wild Horde catches up to them on the other side, and then he sacrifices himself by staying behind and sending them ahead. And they're like, no. And then he's like, I'm going to do it. And then he starts having flashbacks to his dead wife, intercut with this stuff. And it's just hilariously bad.
And my favorite part is he's supposed to go into this like feral rage mode over the death of his family. And the most he can muster is kind of like a half angry face where he's still just doing his squinty Taylor Kitsch eyes. And it's like, you're nothing about what you're doing here is believable in any way.
No, not at all. And because the flashbacks are also interspersed through this, like there's that's supposed to give us the emotional resonance, but does nothing, and it just seems extremely strange because they're like cutting on action of him doing the shovel thing, but then like hurting people, and it's like, but those aren't this stuff isn't really like super related. He's just motivated to protect his newly found associates here.
Yeah. This is an instance that you reminded me of something that I wanted to talk to you about, because you're Mr. Music Boy, and this entire movie, by my estimation, is scored with that sort of like sad dramatic music that makes everything. It's like a moment where a character is supposed to be having some sort of like deep internal reflection, but the entire movie has this sort of like sad downtrodden score. So none of it actually has any connection. And this is another one of those moments where the score is like that, and you're like, ah, this is where he's like letting out his emotions about his dead family, but it's all just the same note, so it doesn't change.
I feel like it's sort of an attempt to mimic what Horner did with something like Glory, or I guess you could say like Troy, but where it's sort of like a solemn battle, and they want you to take this seriously, which is impossible to do. They should have just...
Well, you mean the jumping 50 feet up in the air and the killing giant circular hordes of green things with four arms?
Yeah, there's no emotional resonance, even though they're trying to amp everything and lean on the "you feel emotion" button. The editing is supposed to make us emotional about this. The stakes are supposed to be emotional, and the... music is supposed to be emotional, and we're supposed to be very invested in this peril, except we can't take it seriously because none of this has any real depth to it. None of it has any real gravity to it. It's just sort of as if you had sketched all this stuff out. Like, I have accomplished the checklist of things that should make you feel something.
Hadn't been like doing that with every step of the movie up until this point, it would have worked a little bit, but it's just not... It's not an effective scene in an ineffective movie in general. One thing we didn't talk about, and while I'm just, you know, derailing us temporarily, is the character design and the animation and stuff. I feel like when this first came out, or when I first saw it at least, I was like, wow, it's decent looking CG. Nowadays, we can do better and stuff. But what did you think of the characters and the animation and the what have yous with the effects and stuff?
I mean, it all seemed mostly fine. I mean, it's 2012, so it's room for improvement, but mm-hmm. no, it's fine. And that's because they spent a lot of money doing it. I think the biggest objections that I have are things like when the Thurns are descending from the sky, or when you're doing your moving city thing, that never looked convincing or seemed like it worked in any real way. And a lot of the flyer stuff doesn't seem like, I hate to say, it doesn't feel like it has gravity, but it doesn't feel like it has anything that makes any...
It's supposed to feel like it has gravity. It's magical solar feather ships that are steered with circles.
Yeah, but sometimes they're like, you know, turning on a dime, dropping, popping up, etc., like complete random ways.
Oh yeah, when he was getting the controls wrong and it was like dropping out of the sky, that was a bit unusual.
But then other times you see them and they're moving like very slowly, like these big old battleships, especially the slightly larger Corsairs or whatever that they have in the sky, which is, you know, you'd say like, oh, well, that makes sense because they're larger things. They're harder to move. Except at the same time, it doesn't seem like the small things make any sense in how they operate either. So like they don't seem to have a relative weight to them that is in scale with what the other ones are doing. Their ability is not clearly defined.
Yeah, it's because it's very unclear what is powering them. Is it the sun? Is it the wind? Is it gravity?
There's a point where they say solar, but but it doesn't make a lot of sense when he flies it at night.
Right, because like to turn it on, he basically just turns the solar feathers so they point up so the sun can hit it, and then it like starts flying off the ground or whatever. But
yeah, but they're inside of a covered hangar when he does it, so it's like...
Maybe it has solar cells. It'll store the power in the batteries.
I mean, I don't really need to know the physics of it. It was odd that they in terms of like the effects, that was one of the odder things. And then there's some of the other stuff, like especially at the wedding where they're doing the big set extension for that, where it's not entirely convincing, especially with the big light beam that's there for the, I don't know, moon or whatever, with the mirror and stuff. Like that all just, it just feels very Final Fantasy. And the...
You keep saying that like I have any idea what that means.
Yeah, and the white ape is not convincing either.
That gigantic blind, was it also four-armed?
Yes, but it was covered in bad white fur. I did not care for the design or the execution of that. And there's a point where it's like dead on the ground and its mouth is open and the tongue is lolled out and you can see the teeth, and it just doesn't hold up at that. If you're just gonna like dwell on the interior of the mouth, I don't think they detailed it out enough for that, and I don't think they gave it a good hair groom. But that's really it for that stuff that I really would object to. I don't think that the movie would have been helped by fixing any of those things, and I don't think the movie would have been worse if any of those things had been slightly worse, because they spent $250 million on this movie. It's not really like the CG problem. Like it's just this writing and this acting.
$250 million.
Yeah. And so anyway, they have the thing, and then we're 50 minutes into this podcast. I don't want to recap the whole thing. Suffice to say, there's capturing, and people are traded back and forth and captured by different people, and they go to different places and then get captured and moved around a whole bunch. And people are revealed to be secret double agents.
Accurate summaries I would come up with.
Yeah, well, this whole part just doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't. It goes on
in
forever.
The third act, you got shapeshifters who start shifting shapes.
Yeah.
And sneaking.
And explaining their evil plans, but not killing people.
Yeah, it's just like Mission Impossible 2, where like everyone just starts ripping masks off and suddenly there's somebody else. And it's like, after the second one, you're like, can you stop, please?
Yeah, they were so enamored with Mark Strong being able to shapeshift that they're like, I'm going to shapeshift into this you know, trusted general, and now I'm going to shapeshift into this old lady, and now the old lady's going to shapeshift.
Yeah, walking up the stairs where the camera is just like moving around, and you have somebody like wipe the frame, and then suddenly it's another person like, oh, shapeshifted four times on our way up the stairs, and like you're surrounded by people who would just be like, what did you just? I saw that. Like, I'm right here.
Yeah,
I can see you.
But the problem is, I don't care that he's shapeshifting. It doesn't matter that he's turned into an old woman. It doesn't matter that he's turned into this other guy.
Because nobody knows who they are. So at the same time, he could be walking around in his big fluffy robe, and everyone would be like, "Gee, it's really hot out here. You probably shouldn't be wearing that robe." But nobody would be like, "Hey, you're that guy who's controlling everything," because they don't know who you are, supposedly.
Well. The princess was able to recognize, you know, oh, the Therns used to walk among us, and there's a cave, you know, carving of them. So I don't know if the people of the city would have known.
Beware bald people who wear robes and don't have red face tattoos or whatever.
Yeah, but the important part is that I feel like all of this stuff was done, all this walking around and changing things and freezing and unfreezing John Carter's ability to talk and or move for minutes on end. That I feel like all of this is done just so we can get information from Mark Strong in the form of this monologue, and to try to make it seem interesting, they manipulated as much stuff in the frame as they wanted to or could over the course of this enormous amount of information that's being dumped. It is not an elegant way to do this, and you're not making what he's saying any more interesting by having him do this shape-shifting and having them walk and go on the slowest elevator and in their weird car and all this other stuff. And it winds up ultimately not mattering. And John Carter is able to evade capture because the dog thingy, you know, comes up and there's stuff and things and they get out.
So, movies like this are kind of a balance, right? Like, and we were talking about doing Stargate, which I think is kind of has some of the same stuff going on. Like, it's a balance between the plot that you're going to show and the sort of like mysterious lore that you're going to tell people is kind of like underlying the plot, because that's like it's backstory or whatever. Like, you don't want to get into it, and you got to balance your actual plot mechanics with like how interesting and engaging is this like lore. And in this movie, they completely dropped the ball on like this whole storyline of the Roby people, and you just don't care. So all you're left with is this like very like basic ass plot of going from place to place to place, and like John Carter kisses a girl, and then suddenly they're going to get married.
And it makes it even worse when you go through all of this, and then he gets mildly injured and then vanishes off to go do other stuff, and then they leave on their flying thing, and then he picks up Sola, and then they crash back at the Thark place, and he's there to get Willem Dafoe to help him protect Helium from the evil plan of the wedding betrayal thing that's supposed to happen, but surprise, exactly what you thought would have happened, and Willem Dafoe's not in charge anymore. So Thomas H. Church is the boss, and he throws them all into an arena to do battle, first they get thrown into a jail cell, then they're gonna go to the arena, but in the jail cell, this is where
it's what they say: first Willem Dafoe fights you, and then Willem Dafoe fights with you, and then Willem Dafoe's daughter fights with you, and then you win, and then they respect you or whatever,
just like John Wick. But
mm-hmm.
they have an exchange where Willem Dafoe's depleted and he's tired and he's been fighting all these creatures and the thing, and his only thing that was keeping him alive was that Sola was going to be taken care of, and then John Carter's like, I brought her back and she's going to die. And then he gets a burst of energy and attacks John Carter, which is briefly interesting. And then they're carted off to do battle in the arena. And the arena battle is, if you saw episode 2, you saw this arena battle 2. and I'm not going to get into like what was in the book and who did the book stuff first. You know, like, oh, Edgar Rice Burroughs had this fight in the book, so you know it predates George Lucas's episode 2, and I just want to point out that the way this is shot and put together is very, very similar and reminiscent of the actual, like, execution of the arena stuff that's in that movie. But they go through this stupid fight, and because John Carter can jump, he's been chained one of the numerous times that he gets chained in this movie, and that limits his ability to jump, but he's got a clever plan of just jumping over and over and over again to try to weaken the chain, which doesn't work.
I mean, that was honest. That was my strategy for beating like Mario. So it's gotta work here.
He's just not so bright. But then, fortunately, through several things occurring, the creature tugs on the thingy and it pulls the thingy, and so then he's got the rock piece dangling on the end of the chain. He can smash it against the thing, and then he can use the tip of the thing that was stuck in the rock to break the chain so that he's not in a chain anymore, and we can ignore that. And then he's doing other bouncy stuff, and then Sola rebels, and then both of the monster things are defeated, the white apes are defeated, and then this is when John Carter challenges Thomas Hayden Church to the leadership challenge. And
he's like, you can't challenge me because you're not one of us. And everyone's like, yeah, we gave him a one of us name when we had him for 5 minutes, and in exchange for saving the princess gal. So he is one of us. And he's like, fine, I'll fight you. And they jump towards each other, and he immediately cuts his head off and is like, cool, I win. Like, at least they spared us that battle.
Yeah.
But basically, he just did this because he needs an army to go help him fight the bad Roby Blue guys and stop the wedding and stuff. And then they go to the wrong city?
I'm so angry that they bothered to do that. This is such a long movie. Incredibly long movie.
So the reason they go to the wrong city is because A, it's hilarious, and B, because the Tharks don't fly, mm-hmm. So John Carter has to go out on his own again. But it also it says like, oh no, the stakes are higher because he's out on his own again. He went through all this to get an army, and now the army can't come with him.
They find the one lone guard who's taking care of the city,
right?
And he spills the beans on the plan, which is that all their guards and everything went to Helium, and they've got the city surrounded. They're pretending to guard it, and they're gonna overthrow everything after the wedding. And so that's why John Carter is like, oh, we got to get to Helium. And it's like, well, we went all the way over here, so now there's no way we'll get to Helium fast enough unless we fly. And so he flies on the thingy, and then Sola guilts Willem Dafoe by being like, hey, why don't we just risk everything for this guy for no really good reason? We don't know how to fly or do any of this stuff, so let's go for it. And that somehow convinces him to do it. And then we have Helium and this ridiculous Spaceballs wedding that's going on, and it's going to occur with she's being married off to the evil bad guy, and you get the chalice thing and all the stuff about like, oh, you got your vows, and then predictably, cliche-y, Dominic West drinks the chalice thing, and then she's got to do her I do, and right before she does, John Carter busts in and then starts objecting and breaking things and saying it's a trap, and then everybody's shooting everybody.
Rather than like do the sensible thing and argue like, what are you talking about? It's not a trap, where like everyone would be on his side, Dominic West immediately just starts like shooting people and like flips over the table and like captures the princess. And he's like, you know what? We were going to do this the political way to take over the city, but now that we're here and John Carter kind of like interrupted us, let's just shoot everybody. Yeah. It's fine.
And he hits the thing, which sends the light up through the top thing, which lets everybody in the outside the city know that it's time to invade. And so they do, and everybody in Helium's just like, what? Our mortal enemies are betraying us? And they're caught off guard, so to speak. And they have a big fight, and then finally, the Tharks show up on their airships and start crashing into things. And
they're pretty good at fighting because they got four arms. Mm-hmm. So
that's how it works. You just add more arms, and you're much better at fighting. But yeah, they're all fighting with the Helium guys, and then John Carter is trying to get the amulet thingy and stop Rope Guy. And it's just like, but Rope Guy now suddenly doesn't care and he'll use his powers to do bad stuff now. And then the weapon-y thing that they gave to the bad guy kills the bad guy before he gets the chance to betray them by, you know, I don't know, giving up or something.
And there's also the whole back and forth where Mark Strong turns into the princess and then turns into some, like, another guy, and he's like trying to like, which one is the real princess, John Carter? Which one will you shoot? And it's like, it's all stupid.
It's pretty terrible and very cliche. And so they go through this.
Is there any part of this movie that has not been done before? Like, I get that this is very old text that is underlying this movie, so it's kind of hard for any of it to be particularly groundbreaking. But is any part of this movie something you hadn't seen before, aside from feathery spaceships that fly from God knows how?
I'm going to say no. And, you know, I'm not going to give them the excuse. I'm not going to give Andrew Stanton and Michael Chabon the excuse of, oh, well, you're faithfully adapting the source material, so it's fine that everything's a cliche. You're doing an adaptation. You don't need to make cliches occur. And even if it had been super original when these, you know, serialized pulp novels had come out, you can streamline it, you know, and like sort out some stuff, so that it,
or at
makes
least
more
like
sense
modernize
as a movie.
It so it's not just the same old like Dances with Wolves mixed with other space crap.
It just there's no good reason to have these cliche plot points and action cues and basically everything, where you can predict what's going to occur next, just based on having seen or read other things before. And whether it is immaterial, whether or not that it was in the source material, you're in charge of making a movie that's good and entertaining in 2012, do it. So no excuses. And they have this ridiculous battle that ends with Mark Strong vanishing, and they're just like, oh well, that's too bad, guess we gotta get married now. And they do.
Yeah
he gives her the dead wife's ring thing, and
he proposes in the middle of the battle scene and goes on this very long complicated, would you ever see like a silly man from Virginia? Like, she doesn't know what Virginia is.
No, but they kept saying it funny ways through the beginning of this movie, so it has a deep and resonant impact with us as the audience. But
yeah, like 60% of the content of this movie is people saying Virginia and John Carter with funny accents.
Yeah, and they, but for whatever reason, the father is just like, yep, time to do this wedding for my princess daughter to this guy I don't know, and we're in the middle
of
this.
He saved us. They're fighting on our side, so it's cool.
It doesn't make a lick of sense.
How did he get to be king?
He's horrible at this job. But they go through with the wedding, with people bleeding out and dying all around them. And then we flash forward to them, you know, chilling out in their palatial palace, whatever apartment thing, and she wakes up in the middle of the night and she's like, oh no, John's not here. And she's worried that he's gone, and then she goes and finds him over, you know, looking at the moons and just chilling and just being like, yeah, you know, I think about things sometimes and stuff. And then he wanders off, and Mark Strong shows up, and he's just like, aha, I finally got my revenge. I'm going to send you to Earth. So what a ridiculous thing to do. Just kill him.
Well, because he throws his amulet, and he's like, haha, I know that you won't be able to get back.
Yeah. Wow. But but why not kill him? I don't understand. The Therns they have such incredible power at weird times, and then they just are like the worst when it comes to this stuff, where they're just like, how will I ever get rid of John Carter? I know, I'll send him to Earth. That'll be the best revenge, and then I can go back to murdering everybody else on this planet. I can't Which murder John Carter. Do. Yeah, but it's ridiculous. And so he sends John Carter back to Earth, and John Carter's like, no, my love. And then he uses the gold in the cave to start his company. Oh, and I guess he's shocked by dead Bryan Cranston, who just turned into a skeleton during the course of this movie.
Yeah, so that's the other thing. I think maybe if there's anything interesting about this movie, it's the concept that, like, your body is alive on Earth while you're projecting yourself over on Mars, and you kind of have to protect yourself, and the time moves more quickly on Earth than it does on Mars and stuff like that.
But that doesn't happen till the very end of this movie.
Yes, exactly.
It's so weird.
I mean, like, it's happening the whole time through the narration, through the diary, like the whole, like, they're getting to the point where they're trying to explain, like, I'm not really dead. My body just looks dead because I'm projecting myself to Mars, which is also a fake out because he's not doing that yet, but he's getting ready to go project himself to Mars and his body will appear to be dead. So it's good that he had his mausoleum built ahead of time to lure in the bad thing. I can't remember the name of the thing.
Thurns.
The Mark Strong. Thurns.
Yeah.
So, Thurns, Thurks, Thurn, Bangs, whatever.
Calm down, Yosemite Dan. But they, he's got the fake out of his guys found a thing and he puts it in a box that's got like an amulet shaped hole in it. So it's supposed to be the big clue that he found an amulet.
Yeah, exactly. He pats a guy on the shoulder and then like wraps something in cloth and then puts it in there and he's like, aha, I have it now.
Yeah. And
he doesn't.
Then he uses this to set in motion his plan that he's going to go back to Mars by pretending to be dead. But Mark Strong will know that he's not really pretending to be dead, that he's really secretly alive. He's really
Were we supposed
projected.
To assume that was Mark Strong or if it was just another Thurn?
It was
Thurn
just another Thurn. But, the Thurns, just as a general group, are supposed to be monitoring him and assume that he found an amulet to go back to Mars. And when he does that, they can kill his body on Earth and then it'll work out okay.
Yeah, so suddenly it's the Matrix now.
Yeah, and so Burroughs finishes reading, and the end of it, it's this pleading, urgent cry of, oh, you must quickly go and check on my body, because they probably are already killing me. And it's just like, oh, and he races across the weird London lawn at night. And then he's like, time for a word puzzle. And he's like, Ed, no, that doesn't work. Oh, but he addressed this letter to Ned. He called me Ned. And then he hits the N and the E and the D. And then behind him, a Thurn, who had been disguised as just a pale British man, appears. And this is when he gets killed by John Carter, who wasn't really dead. And then John Carter explains...
And also wasn't in the mausoleum.
No. John Carter explains that the mausoleum can only be opened from the inside, except for, I guess, the N and the E and the D part. But anyway.
Yeah, maybe when he goes in and locks it, it disables the Ned. But...
That doesn't seem smart. But he makes a big deal out of this whole thing where he's just like, and I used a special poison from a frog to slow my heart down so that I'd be declared dead and then I could do that.
And I've been holding on to this bottle for the entire time you've been traveling to London just so I could have a dramatic toss to you and explain what's going on.
That's so ridiculous. And so he's like, but now I've got an amulet because I've got a dead Thurn, so now I can go back to Barsoom, so now you can really guard me for the rest of your life until I'm okay.
Right, and he's like, I was bait. He's like, well, kind of, but also... So much more than bait because you saved me and you brought me an amulet. It's like, well, you're still kind of a dick there, John Carter.
Yeah, he's not the greatest. But then he goes in and he transports back to Mars, and our closing credit is the planet of Mars, and then it says John Carter, and then it has a special JCM logo, and then it goes to the credits.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It sure does.
Yeah. Stay tuned for other John Carter movies because this movie was so beloved.
It's going to be a trilogy.
Whoopsie daisy.
Yeah.
It's real doozy.
Real low value stinker.
I would like to apologize to anybody who deeply cares about the John Carter serialized works.
Are there people that care about?
Yeah, there are a few. I don't know, burrow heads. Ed
well,
heads.
Don't blame us, because we didn't make the crappy movie.
No. Well, but there are some people who are like, oh, but they did a faithful-ish adaptation of Princess of Mars. I saw there was someone who had objected to the fact that it was named John Carter instead of Princess of Mars as being like a major sticking point for that. But I was like, that's an interesting objection, because I don't think that would have changed anything.
No, it's still terrible.
Yeah. It's so bad. But largely in order, it's the bad writing, and the writing is bad. The adaptation is bad. I don't care if you like the original source material. As adapted for screen, terrible. Both in its repetitiveness and its overly long length, and in its bizarre number of twists and turns that it needs to execute that don't really amount to much if you had cut them. And then you layer on your unfortunately non-charismatic main star who's supposed to carry the whole thing, and you layer on a first-time live-action director, Andrew Stanton, who had directed several
things. Speaking of, did you read the Wikipedia article yet?
No.
Okay, I have to read a quote about him.
Mm.
To you, where did it go? Okay, let's see. A month-long reshoot took place in Playa Vista in Los Angeles. The film was shot and blah, blah, blah. Stanton denied assertions that they had gone over budget and stated that he had been allowed for a longer reshoot because he had stayed on budget and on time. However, he did admit to reshooting much of the movie twice, far more than usually common in live-action filmmaking. He attributed that to his animation background. Quote, "The thing I had to explain to Disney was, you're asking a guy who's only known how to do it this way and suddenly do it with one reshoot," he explained later. I said, "I'm not going to get it right the first time. I'll tell you that right now." Stanton often sought advice of people he had worked with at Pixar on animated films, known as the Brain Trust, instead of those live-action experienced working with him. Stanton was also quoted saying, "I said to my producers, is it just me or do we actually know how to do this better than live-action crews do?" And that's pretty much the gist of it. So basically he turned into the skid of the whole, like, the whole Pixar, like, we'll rewrite the movie right up until the last minute, because if it makes for a better movie, like, who cares? And just basically said, like, look, I'm an animator. I don't know how to do live action, but that's okay. That is a feature, not a bug. And it'll be great. Just let me reshoot the movie as many times as possible. And it'll be great. Andrew Stanton, whose next movie was Finding Dory.
Yeah, which is fine. Not amazing.
I enjoyed Finding Dory. I got a little teary-eyed at the end there when they did the things that made you sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. It, you know, it's just not as good or as interesting as Finding Nemo or WALL-E, but it's fine. It was a really unfortunate situation. His inexperience and desire to iterate really backfired on him.
Well, you know, at least now he's got one of the most expensive movies of all time. You know?
One of the most expensive flops of all time.
Yeah, I was going to say that must feel a certain way. But, you know, I had a previous job I had. I had the record for one of the most expensive videos we had ever made, and it was a giant pile of crap, and I do remember how that felt, and it was not great.
Mm.
On the plus side, people cannot watch that movie at all, ever, or video anymore, so I feel better about that, whereas John Carter is on Netflix, and people can go watch that whenever they please.
Yeah.
It's a bad movie.
Yeah. Although, it's strange. Stanton seems to... He still seems to be proud of the movie that he made, which is a question mark that I have.
Well, it certainly put a damper on Taylor Kitsch's career. Yeah. Not that he was, like, on any particular trajectory based on the surrounding works he had performed in, but this didn't help, is what I'm saying.
Well, he was in two large blockbusters that summer. He was in John Carter.
Oh, right.
And he was in Battleship.
Yeah, that worked out well.
Yeah. And then no more of those. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Savages. Then he went to Lone Survivor,
mm-hmm.
which is one of those movies. And then he was in the highly notable True Detective season 2, where he may have been the worst thing in that season, which is very difficult to be.
So I believe that is just universally reviled on every level, but
it's pretty bad, and a lot of it is because of him just squinting and being bad. I mean, the storyline is completely inscrutable too. But
yeah. Well, I think that wraps it up because I can't think of anything else I'd want to say about this movie. I apologize that we don't remember every single name that was used and we didn't take copious notes, but it wasn't worth it.
No.
So if you're upset that we...
I can read some things from IMDb. No. You got your Deja Thoris, you got your Sully, you got your Tars Tarkus, you got your Tal Hodges, you got your Mai Tai Shang, you got your Tardors Moors, you got your Sab Than, your Kantos Kan, your Powell, your Sarkoja, and that's pretty much most of them. And then it starts going into extras' names. Stayman.
Yeah.
Lightmaster.
Also, David Schwimmer was in here as one of the Tharks, and Jon Favreau.
Were they talkie Tharks, or did they just do like motion capture?
I literally could not tell you. I have no clue. I don't recall seeing anything that stuck out to me as particularly Ross-esque or Favrovian. But they were there, so you know.
Did Bryan Cranston only got a last name, Powell.
Yeah, Colonel Powell. And again, why were you in this movie? I don't know. This is so strange. I absolutely do not understand how it just wound its way through the process without anybody being like, so wait a minute, you want to do what now?
Boy. We just got a tweet that says, I think this movie is unfairly maligned and I'm afraid of what you're going to say about it. Sorry.
Sorry. It's
brief.
It's fairly maligned.
Yeah.
Deep apologies, but not really. If you like something and we don't like something, don't take it personally. But at the same time, we are under no obligation to validate anything. So my apologies. On that level,
like, it's they put in some effort to this movie. It's just like I find nothing of value to take away from it.
No, I do wonder if Andrew Stanton could do this as an animated movie.
Why don't they just make it like the Clone Wars TV show?
Yeah, well, but we're you know, I just mean like originally, like if you had a time machine to go back to like 2010.
Oh, if he had the opportunity to make it animated, would he?
Yeah, I mean, I know he wanted this to be live action. He just didn't possess the skills. I wonder if his skills would have been on display in a better way had it been animation, where he could iterate on something and be like, no, unfinal that shot and redo the animation.
Well, but, he's gone on to do some live action television after this. He did 2 episodes of Stranger Things, was it season 2?
Oh, everyone's
an
favorite season.
Saul and an episode of Legion.
No, I'm sorry, Andrew Stanton. I'm sure you're probably a very nice person. I just am totally, totally not behind what you were doing here. Not on the same page.
Mm.
Yep.
Sorry, Andrew.
Yep. All right.
So hot in here.
It's incredibly. Incredibly hot. It's like we're on Mars, except it's cold.
No, I said, Alexa, stop.